Then comes the point of his letter, because there are factions in the community. And if you ever find factions in your own parish community, and there probably will be because we're human beings and we're not all what we are called to be, this might learn from this. He says, "Now I appeal to you, brothers and sisters." That's verse 10. This is the word Paul uses all the time when he's talking about, sometimes they translate it exhort. There's all kinds of translations, but appeal is para kaleo. Kaleo is call, and para means alongside. So whenever Paul, he never tells people, well, I'll say it, it's not quite exactly true, but like, he never tells people what they've got to do. He appeals to them, and that's what the church should be doing all the time. That's all we're supposed to do. People are free. We can only put before each other by a call. Call to something beautiful. People might find it's beyond them. But it's never using people's weaknesses to thrust them down and keep them in control. I mean, that's a shocking sin, isn't it? I mean, it's an awful thing to control an adult. No, it isn't that. But the appeal is there, and Jesus is the one calling, and he's calling through Paul. So Paul sees himself as a mouthpiece of Christ, saying, please, appealing to them. But he is telling them what they need to do, but he's not putting it on them. He's calling them to it. Grace is calling them. I appeal to you, brothers and sisters, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. So in his presence, by his power, by your memory of him, by your calling on him, all of that. That all of you be in agreement, and that there be no divisions among you. The Greek is schisma, schismata in plurals, schismatic. Division is what it means. But that you be united in the same mind and the same purpose. That's quite beautiful. Same mind. Obviously the mind of Christ, that you look at things the way Jesus looks at it, and the same purpose, because they've got a mission in life. They've got things to do, decisions to be made. So purpose is, so thinking the same thoughts, seeing things from the same perspective, and therefore making the decisions from the heart of Jesus himself. For it hath been reported to me by Chloe's people. Here we are. So a boat has come back. Chloe's, whoever's in charge of selling dye or whatever it is, whatever she's selling over in Corinth, and big businesswoman that she is, and good on her. They came back and say, look, in Corinth, things are falling apart ever since Paul left 3 years ago. It's not going well. There are quarrels among you, my brothers and sisters. What I mean is, and then verse 12 spells it out, what I mean is, each of you says, I belong to Paul, or I belong to Apollos, or I belong to Cephas, or I belong to Christ. Now, are we talking about four different groups? Perhaps. Or they're just general. The two key ones are the first two, and they're the only two that he'll refer to for the rest of the letter. So the two key divisions are those who are saying, I'm for Paul and I'm for Apollos. The others are put in there. Did Cephas, that's Peter, ever go to Corinth? Possibly. The bishop of Corinth in about the year 150 wrote a letter to Rome and mentioned in there. So the tradition in the Corinthian church was that Peter did come there. And it's actually fairly unthinkable to think he didn't, because Corinth is such a pivotal point. If he's going to go to Rome, that's a good way to go, through Corinth for a start. And even earlier, and we know he went to Antioch, and we know he's left Jerusalem, so it's very likely that he went there. And since we're told by a bishop that he did, and no other corroborating evidence, let's assume he did. So they knew Cephas, and some probably thought he was a terrific fellow. So here they are, dividing on personalities in this particular group. So now we need a little bit of a pause before we go any further here. I want to just take you back to Corinth and a mood thing, because it becomes basic to what we're going to do from now on. The agora, as you know, is the Greek word for a marketplace. So in Corinth, as in every Roman Greek city in this part of the world, Thessalonica, Philippi, wherever you go, Ephesus, in Rome they had the big main road down the centre and another one across it, so they're built that way. And then there's a big agora there, and all the time the big amusement and the thing everyone looked forward to was some wandering philosopher coming, standing up on a soapbox and proclaiming his theory about the world. There's no TV, remember, no radio. So personality, now they'd be from the most crazy loonies on the left or right to whoever was there, just profound philosophers. They're all spinning out their stories and people would vote on it kind of thing, and they'd crowd and be there and they'd gather. And the Corinthians saw themselves as experts in judging who was a good speaker or not. And they would do it up in the Agora. Here's an entrance to it. This is a modern photo of what's left over of it. And there's the place of the Agora is up there. And you can't really make much out of that. But so you can just imagine that happening. So when Paul went there, he would have been in the Agora. And he would have been... his job was to make canvas coverings to keep the sun off and all that kind of thing, and stuff for tents and camels and whatever else was going on, horses and donkeys, not horses, but all that stuff was going on in the Agora. The key thing that they seem to look for, from all the information we've got today, is... you couldn't be wise, you weren't considered wise, and rhetoric was the key thing to do. Public speaking, oratory was the thing. So if you couldn't speak really well and hold an audience well, you wouldn't be considered wise. So here's Quintilian, who was a Roman writer on the art of rhetoric. He writes, "Eloquence has its fountainhead in the most secret springs of wisdom." Well, what do they judge on? Content, of course, is important, thank God. So what they had to say was very critical, obviously. But the form was what people saw themselves as experts in. And you were supposed to do these four things if you're going to actually... this is in the study books of the rhetoric classes, and that was one of the key things they learned at school, was this, and they used to practice different styles of speaking and different styles of writing in order to speak. Because remember, not everyone read. Most people didn't. So you had to hear if you're going to be exposed to what people had points of view. This, by the way, is a bit of an interesting thing to keep in mind always when people start arguing that Paul didn't write one letter or did write another. Paul at school would have learnt many styles of writing for different purposes. And that was part of their schooling, and he was a master of it. So what they were supposed to do, you had to speak in such a way as to capture the attention of the audience, obviously. You had to present things clearly so that they got the point, understood what you were saying, obviously. You had to have, this is the key, the art of persuasion. You had to persuade people to your point of view, to fight for Athens against Sparta, or to whatever it happened to be, to join Antony and Octavian against Brutus and Cassius up in Philippi. Whatever the thing was, war, trade, you had to win people over by the clever way you presented things. I'm accenting that because that is a key to this whole letter, the part we're going to do today. And the audience, if they retained what you said and actually joined you and said, yes, yes, righto, we'll do that, I think you're right, good, let's go for it, then you're a very successful orator. Now, it's evident that that's according to Quintilian and other writers of the day who talk about rhetoric. So if you can take that as the things they were looking for, well, it's evident, to me at any rate, that on most of these points, Paul was eminently successful. However, the key interest of the populace was in the manner in which the orator used his skill to win people to his cause. That's the key element in all of that. And Paul obviously rated poorly in this area relative to Apollos. Who was Apollos? In the Acts of the Apostles, you might recall, Apollos was from Alexandria, and he was a very skilled orator. And he knew the law very well. And he came over not knowing a lot about Christianity, to Ephesus, and he started to speak about Christianity there, but Aquila and Priscilla took him aside and said, look, you're doing all right, but you're really missing quite a few things, and they had to educate him up, and they sent him over to Corinth while Paul was going back to Jerusalem and up through Antioch and all that. So he's over in Corinth. He's now back in Ephesus with Paul, it seems, from the latter part of the letter. But he's been in Corinth for quite a while and obviously doing wonders there against the Jews, showing how wrong they are, winning people to the church, and a very skilled, lovely person and a lovely orator, and much more skilled in the art of persuasion than Paul ever was. So they're comparing Paul negatively to Apollos. Not only are the Christian community, but other people saying, oh, this bloke's much better than Paul. Listen to him, don't be listening to Paul. Paul really wasn't all that wise. He wasn't that skilled. He was too ordinary. And no, that's what they're kind of going on about. And Paul admits that. If you could look up 2 Corinthians 10:10, the second letter he wrote, I'll just read it to you now. Paul actually says, talking about his detractors, he says, they say his letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak, and his speech is contemptible. He hasn't got that rough, beautiful finesse of Greek language. So that's what they're saying. I'm not saying it's right, but that's the kind of reputation. So what is Paul doing, and what will he argue? And now you can watch it in the argument and see if you agree with my interpretation. Paul argues that their concentration on intelligence, as they understood it, and wisdom, as they understood it, and the persuasive power of eloquence, what it's doing is feeding their pride and their self-sufficiency. It's distracting them from what really matters. And what really matters is the revelation of God in Jesus' love-giving on the cross. And Paul, throughout this beautiful letter, will argue that the content of the message, Jesus crucified, in fact demands the avoidance of rhetorical persuasion. He'll say again and again, I don't want to persuade you about Christianity by my eloquent talk. I would think Paul was quite capable of it, but he refused to do it. He didn't want persuasion to win people over by a kind of, which you see a lot of today, don't you, with a lot of preachers, psychic contagion. Everybody kind of gets wrapped into it and comes in and they're love bombed, and they follow this guru or this preacher or this speaker or this TV evangelist, and they all lose control over their mind and whatever else is going on and join this group doing what groupies around the whoever it is. Paul was absolutely against all that. He said, I refuse to preach anything except Christ crucified. He didn't want his eloquence to be any centre of attention. He kept taking them to the weakness, the folly, the brokenness of the crucified Christ. And it speaks for itself if you look at it. Do you get me? And that's really beautiful. I think I'm so proud of Paul, but I think it's a very lovely thing that this is a very important letter, because he sees them becoming self-opinionated, clever, knowledge, speech, you get it? They're the things they're interested in, rather than love, rather than broken love, compassion, or self-giving. So they're in a dangerous position, and we can all be in it. So he goes on to say, has Christ been divided? Was Paul crucified for you? I don't want groups saying I'm for Paul, because Paul isn't for Paul. Paul's for Christ, and he doesn't want them to be for him. I didn't get crucified for you, he says. Were you baptized in the name of Paul? So he's dismissing any group that follows him. Forget it, he says. I'm not the slightest bit interested in it. You're all wrong. And of course, those following Apollos too. I thank God that I baptized none of you except Crispus and Gaius, so that no one can say that you are baptized in my name. And then there's a bit in brackets. Oh, I did baptize the household of Stephanas. Beyond that, I don't know whether I baptized anyone. Stephanas is the bloke who's brought in the letter from Corinth. We find him in chapter 16. So obviously Stephanas is there, and Paul's beating up this. Stephanas says, well, hang on, you baptized me. Oh, so I did, he says. So he has to add it in later. You can't scrub it out. Well, yes, I did baptize Stephanas, and probably. And then he starts to get a little bit less certain. You think, wait a minute, I can't remember. It was 3 years ago. Who else did I baptize? Which is really nice, I think, and shows you how they wrote. And they couldn't white out what they'd written or get another bit of paper and run it through a typewriter or something, because it's costly business writing. We learn another thing from that little line too. Gaius, we're going to find, is in Corinth, and Gaius has a home in Corinth, and the whole community could gather in it. So Gaius was obviously a pretty important person, and most people lived in little apartments above their shop, kind of thing. But if you've got a house, you were pretty well off. And so Gaius obviously has a house, and they meet. And Paul spent 3 months there, spent the winter of 56, 57 in Gaius's house writing his letter to the Romans. This is a few years after this. So, and Crispus, we know about. Crispus was the leader of the synagogue, who was a convert, it tells you back in. So it seems that what Paul's pretty, he's quite an intelligent missionary. And that reminds us of another thing. Patronage was very important in the Roman world. So, for example, if you'd have these slaves, you'd have other people too who were poor, they'd come to Corinth. Why would they come to Corinth? For trade, for obvious reasons, because it's the trade came through Corinth. That was the cause of it as well. But they also have a big temple there, which we'll hear about later, to Aesculapius, the healing god. People would come there to be healed because there were hot springs and that kind of thing. They came there for the Isthmus is the little part where Corinth dominates. The Isthmian Games every second year. There'd be Olympic Games 1 year, and then the next year there'd be the Isthmian Games. So people would come there for sport. So they'd come for a lot of reasons, mainly trade, and when they came, they had to look round for a patron, someone who would say, oh, well, you can be part of my household, but 20% of the merchandise will come to me, and all this economic stuff that goes on in every culture. Patronage was really important. You had to know somebody who knew somebody to protect you in law and so on. So Paul seems to have gone for people in quite significant positions. Because if Gaius became a Christian, well, everybody that's under his patronage would think, oh, Christian, yes, well, I must look at this. Perhaps I'm interested in this too, And Gaius would say, yeah, I don't know. So there'd be a kind of, not pressure, but an invitation and a possibility of becoming Christian. And then the slaves would automatically become in. Not, I shouldn't say automatically, that's not quite true. But there'd be a lot of expectation that the wife and the family and everyone else would kind of come into this thing. So Paul seems to have baptized few people. Others did that. But the ones he does baptize, he goes to the central cities, doesn't go anywhere, he goes to the place where there's going to be the biggest possibility of the word spreading, and he goes to key people. And when they're won over to Christianity, a lot of people come with them and their influence spreads. So he says, were you baptized in the name of Paul? So what is baptism? Belonging to Christ, we belong to each other, is the point he's making. We all belong to Christ. So you can't have, I'm for Paul, I'm for Cephas, I'm for Apollos, I'm in this denomination, I'm in that denomination, they're on that corner, we're on this corner. Well, that stuff's crazy. We're united to Jesus, we belong to each other. Paul wants them to be attached to Jesus, obviously, not to him. If they're attached to Jesus, everything will go beautifully. If they're attached to him, no point. And baptism isn't like, he's reminding them through underneath this, that you could enter a school, you could enter the Epicurean school or the Diogenes, what was this, the Cynics, or you could become a follower of Aristotle through the Peripatetic school, or you could become part of the Academy and follow Plato. All these different opinions that were raging around the world at that time, and or you could become part of a sect that had come up from Isis and Osiris up from Egypt or something, and you'd belong to a little school and you'd have your guru, well, they wouldn't call him a guru, but your master, your Mr. Gog, who would then invite you into the mysteries of certain religions. Baptism isn't like that. It's not coming under a teacher. It's joining a community of love. It's not like entering a mystic mystery cult. So he says, I thank God, yes, that he didn't baptize, there he remembers, for Christ, he says, didn't send me to baptize. He sent me to proclaim the gospel, and not with eloquent wisdom, so that the power, the cross of Christ, might be emptied of its power. He doesn't want that. He purposely doesn't use, inverted commas, Sophia, it is, wisdom, that is, eloquence and persuasive tricks of speech that would win people over, because he doesn't want the cross of Christ to be anywhere but central, as it is in our churches still. The cross, the crucifix, is, and it is the crucifix, not the cross. The crucifix is central. It's because we're not attracted to the cross, we're attracted to the one on it, who is Jesus. So it's Jesus giving his life for us as crucified is still the architecturally centerpiece, not the tabernacle, but the crucifix of our churches. And rightly so. So the cross of Christ might be empty of its power. The gospel is the good news about God's love as revealed by Jesus, especially on the cross. Nothing can be allowed to distract from this. And the only glory that we must seek is not the glory of being a famous orator or belonging to a famous orator or a groupie following a famous orator. The only glory we must seek is a share in the glory of Jesus, which is the communion of love that he has with his Father and which he communicates to the community.